Now, the toilet flush is sort of a hard act to follow. But what I want to talk about today is if you have the toilet flush in one cell, what happens in the next cell? What determines whether the next cell is going to fire or not? So we have to look a little more carefully at some of the details of the synapse. So if we go back to what we were talking about last time, that you have the presynaptic cell and the postsynaptic. And I should mention that we don't usually draw these to scale, that the presynaptic nerve ending is extremely small compared to the size of the cell body or the dendrite. In many of the pictures, these look the same size just because we're trying to make it clear. So what we've said is that an action potential comes down the axon on the presynaptic side, and that causes calcium to come into the cell through the opening of voltage-gated calcium channels, and that causes exocytosis. Calcium in general promotes exocytosis, and that causes exocytosis of vesicles containing neurotransmitter, and they end up in the synaptic cleft, in the space between the presynaptic and the postsynaptic cell. And now there are, of course, receptors on the postsynaptic cell. Now, Dr. Feierstein mentioned who the major transmitters are here, that in the central nervous system, they're usually amino acid derivatives, and that glutamate is the primarily excitatory and GABA is the primary inhibitory. We're going to be concerned mostly with what happens in the peripheral nervous system, in the PNS, and we'll talk more about its setup later. And here, the two major transmitters are usually norepinephrine, although sometimes it's epinephrine. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Norepinephrine and epinephrine and acetylcholine. Now, any one neuron releases a single major neurotransmitter at its synapse, end of its axon. And if the neuron is branched, as some are, if the axon is branched, the same neurotransmitter will be released at both synapses, or all synapses. Now, when we talked about hormones, we said that the effect of the hormone very much depends on the receptor, and that many hormones have multiple kinds of receptors. The same is true for many of these transmitters. Some of these transmitters have only one kind of receptor. But in fact, as you'll see, each of these has two major types of receptor. And so what is going to happen in the receiving cell is going to depend very much on the receptor end. And we'll talk more about the details again. But before we think about the receptor, consider the neurotransmitter sitting in the synaptic cleft. Just as with hormones, you want the signal to be transitory and then end. And so you want to clear the path for the next signal. So you have to get rid of this neurotransmitter. Now, there are several different ways of doing that. In some cases, the neurotransmitter simply diffuses away. The size of this cleft or space is very small. So compared to the volume of extracellular fluid here, it's tiny. And so just by diffusion, the neurotransmitter can be effectively diluted and lost. In other cases, there is actually an enzyme in the cleft which destroys one of the transmitters. And the most famous example of that is acetylcholine esterase, which destroys acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is an acetate group linked to choline. And acetylcholine esterase breaks this connection. And then it turns out the choline is reused and the acetate is just lost. And that leads to the third way of getting neurotransmitters, which is reuptake. So they can diffuse away, they can be degraded, and they can be reused. So they can be taken up by the presynaptic cell, put back into a vesicle, and used again. And this is true for some transmitters whole, and in the case of acetylcholine, for the choline part. And two examples of neurotransmitters which are taken up again are norepinephrine and serotonin. I think I better turn it down a little bit. Okay, that didn't help. I think it's one of the other electronic devices, but it's hard to tell. Okay, so these two are taken up and reused. And this explains why what happens if you prevent their reuptake or their degradation. Excuse me? It's this one? This one? This one? Oh. So move this. Let's try it. If I move it too far away, you can't hear anything. That doesn't look good, does it? No, that's better. Now you can't hear anything, but we'll try that. Well, it's a little bit better. So the point here is that if you prevent the degradation of acetylcholine by inhibiting this enzyme, or if you inhibit uptake by the carriers, then the neurotransmitter stays around and continues to stimulate. And this can be a good thing or a bad thing. The drug malathione, it's not a drug, it's a poison. Malathione is a poison used as an insecticide, which poisons acetylcholine esterase. And that's why the bug goes into spasms, because the acetylcholine just stays. Acetylcholine is actually what triggers muscle contraction, and it just stays there in the bug and dies. Fortunately, it doesn't have much effect on human acetylcholine esterase. On the other hand, this is bad, at least for the bug, and many nerve gases do something similar, and that's bad for people. But on the other hand, Prozac and the other related drugs are selective retake inhibitors of serotonin. So when you take Prozac, the serotonin, which is a derivative of tryptophan, which is being used as a neurotransmitter, remains longer in the synapse and has a larger effect for the same amount of release. Now, this may not be the only effect of Prozac, but this is probably at least one of them, that it effectively increases the signaling by serotonin. Yeah?
You had said that the same neuron, the axons, will release the same neurotransmitters. So does that mean that each neuron only has one neurotransmitter?
Does each neuron have only one neurotransmitter? It has one major neurotransmitter, yes. Yeah? No. Okay. All right, so that's what I wanted to say about the presynaptic side, and now I want to focus a little bit on the postsynaptic side. Are there any other questions, though, about the presynaptic business? Okay, so let's go to the postsynaptic side and see what happens over here. Now, depending on the neurotransmitter and its cognate receptor, what happens over here can be either inhibitory or excitatory. Now, maybe the way to think about that is the cell has if this is the membrane voltage, that a cell can, I want this to be threshold. Let this be threshold. And this is the resting membrane potential. So we know that you have to change the resting potential, membrane potential, up to threshold before you can fire an action potential. Now, of course, the resting membrane potential is negative. I'm just going to say it's less than zero, which is why the membrane is said to be polarized and negative. And as Dr. Feierstein explained last time, when you change the resting membrane potential in this direction, when you move it towards zero or beyond, that is depolarization. And when you increase the resting membrane potential in the sense that you make it more negative, or you go away from threshold, that's hyperpolarization. Now, the transmitter can have one or the other of these effects. A transmitter can open, a transmitter opens ion channels, and either, what's the effect of that? It depends on which ions move, and depending on which ions move, this change in selective permeability, either the membrane potential becomes depolarized and closer to threshold, or hyperpolarized and further from threshold. Now, which of these goes with an excitatory postsynaptic potential? Which of these is likely to make the postsynaptic cell easier to fire? It's going to be this one. So any transmitter that has this effect is excitatory, and one that hyperpolarizes is inhibitory. Now, whether something is excitatory or inhibitory depends on the transmitter receptor combination. Some transmitters are always one or the other. Their receptors always do the same thing. But some transmitters can be one or the other, depending on which receptor they hit and what the effects are. Now, what's going to happen over here is that courtesy of the chemical, the neurotransmitter, we're going to open or close some channels. And these are going to be ligand-gated channels. So we're going to get a small change here. We're going to get a small change in polarization due to ligand-gated channels. When one action potential comes down the presynaptic side, we release some vesicles, a certain amount of neurotransmitter, and that either causes a small depolarization or a small hyperpolarization. And that change due to a single action potential is usually called either an EPSP if it's excitatory, and an IPSP if it's inhibitory. Excitatory postsynaptic potential, inhibitory postsynaptic potential. When people talk about an ESP, they mean the amount of depolarization caused by the transmitter release due to a single action potential. So this is the size of the package from one action potential, either an excitatory or inhibitory. Now, what's going to happen is there are going to be multiple inputs here, and it's going to be their net effect that's going to determine the total postsynaptic potential, and therefore whether the next cell fires. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But before we do that, I want to say a little something about receptors. How does a receptor cause the opening of channels or the closing of channels, and a change in the polarization of the cell, hyperpolarization or depolarization? There are actually two major types of receptors here. Doesn't seem to make any difference. So I'm just going to put it back. That's for posterity on the tape. Okay, so we're talking here about ligand-gated receptors. And what's going to happen is that if you open enough ligand-gated receptors, that will cause enough change in voltage to open voltage-gated receptors. But just thinking about the ligand-gated receptors that you can have, as Dr. Feierstein mentioned, there are two kinds, which are called ionotropic or direct, and metabotropic or indirect. Now, what do we mean by this? An ionotropic or a direct receptor is itself a channel. So the channel itself, some piece of it, binds the neurotransmitter, and the channel opens. In these cases, the channel always opens in response to binding its ligand. The most famous case of this is one of the major acetylcholine receptors. Now, you remember we said before that there are two kinds, a long time ago. The receptors for norepinephrine, those are the adrenergic receptors, and they come in two kinds, alpha and beta. Well, in the same way, acetylcholine receptors, which are called cholinergic receptors, come in two forms. Now, before you panic, the four major types of receptors are listed at the end of the notes in a table for getting all the details right. But what we're considering now are the receptors for acetylcholine, which are called cholinergic. And there are two major kinds, and one kind is called the nicotinic cholinergic receptor. Now, it's said the cholinergic receptor means it binds acetylcholine. Nicotinic means it also binds nicotine. Now, this particular receptor is itself a channel. And when people talk about the adenylcholine, the acetylcholine receptor, they mean this one. This is the kind that is found between muscle and nerve. This is the kind that gets hit by malathion and makes the bug collapse. So this is the most famous acetylcholine receptor, and it is itself a channel. Now, what about a metabotropic receptor? The other kind of acetylcholine receptor is called muscarinic. So this one is nicotinic. And that's because it binds a compound from Amanita muscaris, I think, from a poisonous mushroom called muscarin. And this is also binds acetylcholine, but this receptor is not itself a channel. This receptor is a G protein-coupled receptor. Now, there's more than one kind, as usual. There's not just kinds, but there's subkinds. There are many subkinds, but all of these are G protein-coupled receptors. And what happens next depends on which of the various signaling pathways, IP3, cyclic AMP, etc., is triggered by the G protein-coupled receptor. Now, why mess around with this? Why not just open a channel and get it over with? This system allows you only to open a channel. But by using a G protein coupled receptor, you can get many different responses in the cell. You can close a channel, you can activate proteins, kinases, etc. You can even trigger transcription. So the possibilities here are much larger as to the number of things you can get the cell to do, because the number of signaling pathways is larger. But what's the problem with this one? This one is slower. So this one is slower, but it's more versatile. Okay. All right. Yeah?
I have a question about the ionotropic channels. So even though the channel itself opens, depending on the ion that of the channel that's opening, it might have an excitatory or an inhibitory effect?
Okay, so the question now is, what about excitatory and inhibitory effects? How do you do that? And I realize I forgot to say it. So, ionotropic channels, in the acetylcholine receptor, opens a generalized cation channel. These can either open or close channels, and they can be various types. But the question that she's asking is, when you open a channel, how can you sometimes get hyperpolarization and sometimes get depolarization? And it depends what kind of ion channel you affect. Now, just talking about opening channels, not worrying about closing them. If you were to open a generalized cation channel, which allows both, you probably should say single charge, which allows both sodium and potassium to flow, what do you think would happen to the polarization of a cell? So think about what a cell looks like. Where is there more potassium? Inside. Where is there more sodium? Outside. So that's the chemical gradient. But what about the electric potential? What are we close to? We're actually close to potassium's equilibrium potential and very far from sodium's. So that means that potassium is approximately, is close to equilibrium. So if I open a channel which allows calcium to go, a little calcium, potassium, a little potassium will go out, but not a lot. But what if we open a channel that allows sodium? As we know, sodium will pour in. So if the channel allows them both to go, much more sodium comes in than potassium goes out. So a general cation channel is going to do what? Overall, depolarize, hyperpolarize. The cell's going to get plusser overall because more sodium's going to come in than goes potassium out, and so that's going to cause depolarization and be excitatory. Now, what about becoming hyperpolarized? So this is how you depolarize. To hyperpolarize, it's usually one of two things. It either affects chloride or potassium. If we just let potassium flow, remember the cell is not completely at equilibrium for potassium. And so if you make more permeability to potassium, a little more potassium will go out. So this will make the cell more negative because a little more potassium leaves. Alternatively, what if you let chloride move? Chloride is higher outside, and its equilibrium potential is more negative. It's not that far from equilibrium either. So if you let chloride flow, it will generally go in. Now, when you open either chloride or potassium channels, you can have one of two effects. Either the cell becomes hyperpolarized, or you simply stabilize the current state of depolarization, so that it makes it harder to fire, not necessarily because you changed the resting membrane potential, but either because you made it more negative or because you made it more stable at the volume, at the level at which it already is. So this is what happens at inhibitory synapses. Now, we want to come back and consider, what is the net effect here? If you have multiple IPSPs, inhibitory postsynaptic potentials, and multiple excitatory postsynaptic potentials, and you sort of take the algebraic sum, you get an overall postsynaptic potential here. We'll discuss how it's summed in a minute. How are these different from action potentials? Well, there's actually a lot of differences. Remember the famous toilet? Action potentials are all or nothing. It flushes or it doesn't. But this is different. This is a graded potential. The more input you get, the more depolarization or the more hyperpolarization. So these, unlike action potentials, are graded They vary in size, which action potentials do not. They're also local. An action potential travels very long distances. Why is that? Because it regenerates itself. Just as you burn the fuse here and that ignites the next one and that ignites the next one and that ignites the next one, ye old positive feedback kind of thing. Here, postsynaptic potentials fade out. They're not regenerated. So if they go too far, they fade out. Another way of looking at it is that they are caused by ligand-gated channels, while action potentials are regenerated using voltage-gated channels. So, the action potential then is the big bang of positive feedback. You reach a critical value, and then you get a huge response. Postsynaptic potentials may generate a big bang, but they themselves are not. They don't reinforce themselves. Now, maybe I should say something. Yeah?
Is it really positive feedback in a technical sense? Because it's not.
The generation, his question is it really positive feedback? The generation of an action potential is considered positive feedback. The generation of a spike is. In that the positive. The way biologists see it, maybe not the way engineers see it, but the way biologists see an action potential is that one voltage-gated channel opens another voltage-gated channel, which opens another voltage channel. You don't turn yourself off, you turn yourself on progressively. Perhaps the other way of thinking about it is here that a small amount of depolarization triggers a big spike. Instead of the turnoff of the depolarization, the correction of the depolarization, which would be negative feedback. But if it doesn't exactly match engineering terminology, too bad. Okay, I may not. Dr. Feierstein talked about the big flush theory of the action potential. We talked earlier about the Big Bang theory of signaling, and maybe it's worth just saying how this all fits in. That what we said before is when you have a small signal, and you could say, this is a small signal, how do you get a big result? So one way you get a big result, and it's with hormones, is you trigger a cascade of changes in the cell of phosphorylations, modifications, and amplifications. Another way is triggering transcription and translation, which also gives you an amplification. And we mentioned a third kind of Big Bang, and that's the kind we're looking at actually here, in the generating of an action potential, and of course, I guess down here, that small changes due to ligands open a small number of ligand-gated channels, and that in turn opens voltage-gated channels, which open more voltage-gated channels and give you the Big Bang or the action potential or the flush. So the question is, are we going to get the flush here? Is this cell going to fire an action potential? And that depends on the net input from all of the axons feeding into this cell. Now, this postsynaptic cell could have 100,000 inputs because most neurons have many neurons synapsing on their dendrites and cell body. So how do you put together all the input? And a diagram of summation is on your handout for today. On the bottom of A, 22A. Now, what we've drawn here is a cell. This is meant to be the cell body with its dendrites. Here's the nucleus, and here's the axon. And in this picture, there is myelin around the axon. And this is where you would get the action potential. So this is meant to be the postsynaptic cell. And we have the presynaptic cell here. Here's the axon of the presynaptic cell. Now in this picture it looks like the axon is inside the postsynaptic cell. But that's not what it means. This presynaptic cell is synapsing on the membrane or the outside of the postsynaptic cell. Now, suppose you have an action potential coming in here, and you see it says E1, because this is excitatory. This synapse is excitatory. So if you have one action potential generating an EPSP, what happens? What if you were to record somewhere down here, or perhaps we should say right here? It'd be better to say right here. So if we were to record right here, what would happen? You would generate a small depolarization in this part of the membrane, but it would die out. It wouldn't generate an action potential. Now, you notice there are two of them. When you have in your picture something like where it says like these arrows, that's where the stimulus or the input or the firing of the presynaptic cell is, and you get a depolarization, but it's subthreshold and it dies out. That's your first picture. But what if in the second picture what's meant to happen is you fire an action potential in the presynaptic cell, and then you fire a second one right away? That means that the second one comes before the first one has died off. So the second one adds on top of the first one, and the net result is to go over threshold, and as a result, you would indeed fire an action potential here. Now, as we mentioned last time, this area here has the most channels and is the most trigger-happy section. It's sometimes called the trigger zone, the initial segment, or the axon hillock. And this is actually where summation occurs. It's the input to this area from all the various parts of the cell body and the dendrites which determine what happens. All these changes essentially are passively transmitted along the membrane, and they're summed here. And if they go over threshold, then you fire an action potential. Now, the third case shown here is a little different, and it's a different kind of summation. The first kind, we said, you fire two action potentials in rapid succession. One EPSP by itself is not enough to trigger the postsynaptic cell, but one piled on top of a second may be. But what if instead of having one, you have two excitatory inputs? So both of these fire at the same time. You get an action potential from this input and an action potential from there. Well, both of these are added up. So this is a spatial summation as opposed to a temporal. Temporal or time dependent, too close together in time. Spatial, too close together in space. And if these depolarizations reach the axon hillock at the same time, they add up and the cell will fire an action potential. Now there's only one more thing to consider. Cells don't just get excitatory inputs. They also get inhibitory inputs. And what happens really depends on the algebraic sum. So in the third case, we've added an inhibitory synapse, which means that this causes a local, what kind of polarization? We're going to get hyperpolarization and depolarization. And if the net sum goes over threshold, we get an action potential. If not, not. And in the case actually shown, In your last case, you only have one excitatory and one inhibitory, and they essentially cancel each other out. So if they both fire at the same time, you don't get enough depolarization to fire an action potential. Yes?
You said the excitatory potential were transmitted passively to the axon hillock.
Mm-hmm. So the question is, excitatory changes are transmitted passively to the axon hillock, so are inhibitory. So that this is where the integration is taking place. Yes?
Since the receptors are ligand-gated, does it matter how far away from the initial segment the signal is?
If the, since these are ligand-gated receptors and the change has to pass, yes, it probably does make a difference where these are. Her question is, if these synapses are further away, do they have less effect? And I suspect yes, but I don't know the details. Okay. So let's see if I forgot anything. I think I just want to reiterate that there can be hundreds or even thousands of inputs to this cell, and so what it's going to do depends on its net input. And this cell essentially is an integrative, every cell is an integrative center for all of its inputs. Now, we have been talking here almost entirely about how you get the word from one end of a neuron to the other end of the neuron, or from one neuron to the next neuron. Once the neurons start firing, how do you keep it up and get it to the end of the line? But we know that you get an awful lot of input from the outside, from light, vision, etc., hearing, touch. How does an external stimulus get into the nervous system and get carried to the brain so that you can actually do something? So that's what I want to talk about next. And I want to talk about what are called sensors. And it might be easier if what we do here is to summarize sort of the main picture, and then we'll go into more of the details. So the basic idea, what we've been talking about so far, is how do you get an action potential? How do you get a long-distance signal? You have to open some ligand-gated channels, which opens some voltage-gated channels, and then you get your long-distance signal. Now, the difference with sensors is you don't necessarily use ligand-gated channels. In fact, you never use ligand-gated channels directly. What you do is light or sound or touch or taste indirectly opens channels. Directly or indirectly opens channels. So your stimulus opens channels. Now, this may be direct or indirect, as we'll explain, but these are not that a chemical binding to a channel opens it. I want to put off exactly how we open the channel for a minute. But the point is you just open a few channels, as with ligand binding, opening a few channels. But now, opening these few channels changes the polarization of the cell and can open voltage-gated channels. So that causes, so maybe we should say, this is a few channels, and you get a small change in polarization. Usually it's a depolarization. But this then, this if it hits threshold, opens voltage-gated channels. So what's the big deal? What happens if you open voltage-gated channels? Then you generate ye olde action potential, you get the flush. So now you get an action potential which can be transmitted through the nervous system to the brain, effector, or whatever you need. So what you want to figure out is how this works. And there are actually two parts to it. So part one is sort of how do you open the channels, and then part two is once you do that, how do you actually generate the action potential? As we'll see, sometimes these two happen in the same cell, and sometimes it takes a two-cell relay. This is very annoying. So somebody tell me how to change this, besides turning it off, which I can do. Let me just turn it down a little bit more. Sometimes that does it. Of course, then you can't hear me as well, but it doesn't make those horrible noises. Okay, so first let's look about the channel business. Okay. Now, you have, in order to do this, you have specialized cells which have receptors, that is, receptor proteins for the various stimuli, whether it's heat, light, etc. So you have receptor proteins. Now, they open channels. Sometimes they themselves are a channel. This is the same business we talked about before, where you have the two kinds of receptors, direct and indirect. And I actually want to write it a little differently. I want to write it this way. Now, in this case, chemicals don't open the direct channels. What opens the direct channels is either mechanical pressure, which is involved in balance, hearing, touch, stretch. So mechanically, the mechanical energy deforms the receptor, which is part of a channel, and that opens the channel. So it's not ligand binding, but a mechanical force or a change in temperature. And these deform the protein and open the channel. So this is a direct effect. On the other hand, for some stimuli, for other so-called modalities, that is, other things like hearing, vision, etc., you have, not hearing, but for vision and for taste, you have an indirect system, meaning that the chemical, all the chemical ones work this way. So that means taste and smell and also vision. In these cases, when you get a photon or a chemical, what it does is to bind to a G protein coupled receptor. The G protein coupled receptor is activates a G protein, and the G protein then triggers either directly opens a channel or triggers a second messenger that opens a channel. So remember, these all work through G protein coupled receptors. The receptor is not itself a channel. Now, the responses you get here are graded, just as you did with a postsynaptic potential. The more stimulus you get, the more change in polarization in the cell. Until, if you go over threshold, an action potential is fired. Now, what do you call that change in the potential of a cell? These are not postsynaptic. These are the sensory cells with their receptors. So the change in the resting membrane potential due to the stimuli is called a receptor potential, or sometimes a generator potential. Today, this is the most common term that is used. But some people say a generator potential instead. And there are some people distinguish these two, and the fine points are explained in the notes, but we'll stick largely to receptor potential, although this term may be used in the problem book. So this is called a receptor potential because it's caused by a change in the receptor protein. Well, we've got ourselves here a proportional change in polarization in our special sensory cell. But how does that generate an action potential? We said it could be a one-cell or a two-cell relay. So what do we mean by that? What's the difference between a one-cell system and a two-cell? So in a one-cell system, this is meant to be very diagrammatic. The cell has two parts. In one part, you receive all this input from the stimulus, photons, chemicals, whatever it is. And if the cell changes in polarization beyond threshold, you fire an action potential. And of course, that releases chemicals to the next cell, another action potential, etc. So this is a one-cell system. And in this case, the receptor cell, the cell that's doing this, is in fact itself a modified neuron. Now we have a problem here. There are cells called receptors, and there are proteins called receptors. This is a sensory cell, but it's also called a receptor cell. Not my idea, but people do it. So this is a receptor cell which contains receptors for photons, chemicals, mechanical pressure, whatever. So you have to remember there are receptor proteins and receptor cells. Now, in a two-cell system, there is the receptor cell with its receptor proteins, but it does not fire an action potential. It may be a modified neuron. Often it is not. So what it does is to release neurotransmitter. And the amount of neurotransmitter released is proportional to the stimulus and the change in polarization. So where is our action potential? That's in the next cell. So now there's what you might call an ordinary neuron here. And if this is a kind of an ordinary postsynaptic neuron, and if it gets enough input and goes over threshold, it will fire an action potential. So how are these two different? Why would this fire an action potential and that doesn't? What protein must this have that this one doesn't? What do you need to fire an action potential? You need a lot of things, but there's one special obvious thing.
Calcium channel?
Well, you do need... What do you need the calcium for?
Release the...
Well, you need calcium to release neurotransmitter from the end here. But to carry the action potential from here to there, what do you need? He says myelin if it's long enough. What propagates the change here along here? What makes one flush do another, do another, do another, do another, do another? Ye old voltage-gated channels. It's not enough to have ligand-voltage channels. You have to have voltage-gated channels in here. So the initial change at the axon hillock, the initial segment, can actually trigger an action potential, which triggers an action potential, which triggers. So this cell may not even have much of an axon at all, but the point is it does not have voltage-gated channels, so it cannot generate an action potential. Yeah?
Then how does it release the...
How does it release transmitter? It... The local depolarization is sufficient to cause enough changes here in the polarization to affect calcium and cause release of transmitter. So what we have here is only local graded changes in potential, no voltage gated changes. Question? Yeah.
Are there animals that don't have, that somehow do action potentials without myelin?
Are there cells that do action potentials? Well, there are cells that do action potentials without myelin. But there aren't very long cells, as far as I know, long axons that don't have myelin. But I am sure that there are simpler organisms that do everything you can think of simpler than this. Yeah?
Over here you said that there's binders for photons.
Mm-hmm.
How does...
Well, they're in the visual receptors... You have a protein that when it binds a photon or is hit, but when it's hit by a photon, changes conformation. And that is what triggers the events that lead to vision. Now, we haven't I'm not going to go into all the details here. I'm going to do a couple of examples, but there are many different modalities, that is, hearing, vision, balance, etc., and each one has its peculiarities, and all the details are explained in all the books, but we want to just get the basic idea here. So if we go back to the possibilities, you can see there's sort of four combinations here. You can have a direct receptor or an indirect receptor, and then you can have a one-cell or two-cell system. So just to give some examples of these... The simplest, maybe, is stretch, which is, of course, a kind of mechanical response. The stretch receptor itself is a modified neuron. It is a channel. It essentially itself opens a channel. When you stretch, you open a channel, and that same cell fires an action potential. So this is a direct system and one cell. But balance and hearing are also direct systems. These are other mechanical systems where the physical push or stimulus, hearing, you don't think of hearing as being physical, but the sound waves do it, that you have here a physical stimulus which opens a channel, but that cell itself does not fire an action potential. It triggers another cell to fire an action potential. Now, if we consider indirect systems, a one-cell system is smell or odor. This is what Dr. Feierstein works on. And vision and taste are two-cell systems. So that means here the stimulus affects a G-protein coupled receptor, which activates a G-protein, which activates an enzyme, which generates a second messenger, etc. So in the case of smell, which is a one-cell system like this, it's simple enough that you can sort of write it out that the stimulus is what people call an odorant or a smelly substance, a chemical, and it binds it to its receptor. So you have the ligand binds its receptor, and that's a G-protein coupled receptor, so it activates a G-protein, which activates adenyl cyclase. So you end up with cyclic AMP going up. And it's the cyclic AMP that opens a cation channel. So it opens one of these general cation channels, the kind we talked about here, that allows both sodium and potassium to move. Sodium moves more than potassium. So this cell is depolarized and fires an action potential if you have enough odorant. Now, what's proportional here and what isn't? The more ligand, the more depolarization. Or maybe we should say the more ligand, the more activated adenyl cyclase, the more cyclic AMP, the more open channels, the more depolarization. But the action potential is all or nothing. So how does your brain know if you smell a lot? There's a lot of this stuff. You're going to fire more action potentials. The information, I think as Dr. Feierstein said last time, that you get to your brain, the intensity of the stimulus determines the number of action potentials per second. And that's how you record intensity. Lots of smell, lots of light. How do you know whether it was smell or light? That's from the wiring diagram. Because the nerves from your eyes go to one part of your brain, and the nerves from your nose go to a different part of the brain. And as he pointed out last time, were you to switch it, you would get some very strange effects. Because you would smell something, stick it in front of your nose, and you would see light. Now, he gave an example of how you can confuse the wiring diagram, that if you get punched in the eye, you see stars or light. There is a more subtle and less drastic version. If you take a very sharp pencil and you go like this, and then try it again on here and see if you notice any difference. Because the pressure triggers something here, a sensor, which is not a pressure sensor. Try it yourself. I'm not going to tell you what happens. You can ask me next time. Okay? Okay. All right. Now, yeah.
Is the intensity of the signal proportional to APs? Is it the number of APs per cell or the number of cells firing APs?
Does the intensity of the stimulus affect the number? It affects the, if this cell is triggered, the more the intensity of the stimulus, the more APs per second. But if the stimulus is over a wider area, then it will stimulate more receptor cells.
But what does the brain
And then the brain gets input from more cells, and it perceives that. That's how you know whether the smell is just here or it's all over the room. Any more questions about this? Yeah.
Is the ligand the actual chemical from which you're smelling traveling through the air?
Yes. In this case, the ligand is the actual chemical you smell traveling through the air. Turns out you have thousands of different receptors, which is why you are able to smell so many different things. Yeah?
What am I supposed to feel when I poke myself?
What do you feel? Now, try poking here. No, gently. The thing is that when you do this, you have a sensation which you think is the lead in the pencil. And then when you do it here, you realize it's different. I don't want to give it away particularly. Now, just try it.
Yeah. Is there some method of down-regulation of smell receptors? Because bad smells typically go away.
Most receptors become saturated and then you don't notice anything. And I don't remember the exact mechanism for that. But it is true, most stimuli you adjust to. And after a while, you don't hear them. I mean, you can be in a very noisy room, and if you're in the right frame of mind, you don't hear anything. Yeah.
Are we supposed to feel ticklish?
All right, I give in. You have a lot of cold receptors here, and usually you think it's the lead in the pencil, that lead is like that. But if you go like this, it doesn't feel cold. Oh. Okay. So try it. Okay. So what we've talked about here... You are a pretty funny looking class. What we have talked about here is almost... We've talked about getting the message in from the outside into the nerve and passing it down the nerve. But then how does something happen? A signal has to reach an effector and the effector has to do something. So what we want to talk about now, very briefly, is simple circuits. And these are on your handout on the other side. Well, we've tried to show you how something, how you have an action in response to a stimulus. And the one we've used here is the stretch response, which is one of the simplest. And if you have a muscle cell and it has a stretch receptor, which is what this symbol is meant to indicate. This, remember, a stretch receptor is a one-cell system. So the same cell whose endings are stretched literally will fire an action potential. And this cell has its body on the side, cell body on the side, which is why I drew it like this. And here is the nerve ending, the synapse. And now this is the simplest possible circuit in that it involves one synapse. This is a monosynaptic circuit, but it involves two neurons. So here is the second neuron, the postsynaptic neuron, and it actually feeds back onto the same cell. Now, what do you need this for? If you pick up a heavy box or even the average textbook, you have to contract your muscles in order to even just to hold it, to counteract the force of gravity. And of course, to pick it up, you have to contract your muscles even more. So how do you contract your muscles to balance the stretch? Why don't you either drop the book or sort of fall over because you pull too hard? And the answer is that the stretch is detected in your muscle, and that sends a message in. This is a sensory neuron, or one of those effector cells, one of these receptor cells. This is its actual receptor proteins are in the nerve ending. And the stretch triggers an action potential in the nerve. And then that releases an excitatory stimulus to the second nerve. This is actually a motor neuron, as opposed to a sensory neuron. And now the information that came in goes back out and triggers contraction of the muscle to balance the stretch. So what's the effector here? It's just the muscle, skeletal muscle itself is the effector. Now, this is a reflex, and this is part of the central nervous system. This synapse is in the spinal cord. But remember, the spinal cord and the brain make up the central nervous system. And input from the brain can affect this. We're talking about in-out, sort of in from the muscle back out to the muscle. But you also have an up-down component controlled by the brain, which influences what happens. Remember, there are multiple inputs to this cell. But we've left that off for the moment. And this is actually what happens when they, well, the second one is what you, the second picture is what you need, why when they tap your knee you kick. Now, this implies you're only worried about one muscle at a time. But most of the time when you do anything, you have two muscles that are involved. When you do something like this, to extend, you have to relax this muscle and contract this one. To flex, you have to do the reverse. You have to contract this muscle and extend this one. You always have antagonistic pairs of muscles. And when one contracts, the other has to relax. Now, the way muscle works, as we'll discuss next time, is there is a signal to contract. Lack of signal means relax. So what you have to do, if you're going to do this, is you have to signal this muscle to contract and turn off the signal to this muscle so it will relax. So the second picture shows how you do that by adding another feature. That the incoming neuron is actually branched. And remember, there are two muscles, not one. These are the two antagonistic muscles. And depending on what you want to do, you want to signal one on and one off, or the reverse. So in this case, not only do you want to contract this muscle, but at the same time, you want to relax the bottom muscle. So you have now two synapses, but these are both excitatory. So how are we going to inhibit this one? We have what is called an interneuron. And this is a neuron whose only job it is to convey the message from one neuron to another neuron. And your brain is actually mostly made up of interneurons. So all of this, again, is in the spinal cord. And these two are excitatory synapses, but this is an inhibitory synapse. So this means that the stretch signal signals that particular muscle to contract, and at the same time, through the interneuron, it inhibits the other muscle, antagonistic muscle, from contracting. Yeah.
So in the way the neurons are arranged, is there any reason why it works that way versus only having two, maybe one neuron sending a message?
The question is, I think she's asking, is why isn't this plus and this minus?
No, I'm just why do you need all three? Can only one neuron do one job or something? Can one neuron?
Well, notice you have to get a minus to this cell and a plus to this cell.
And that neuron can't send a...
This neuron apparently can only send... Either this transmitter can only be excitatory, or the receptors for this transmitter on this type of cell can only be excitatory. So this can, these have to give you the same transmitter. So apparently in this system, it has to be excitatory. And so you can't have this one be negative directly on here. You have to have this one excite an inhibitory neuron.
And the one at the top can't send a message.
Remember, this has to be a minus.
No, the one that's plus right above.
Here?
To the left. Can it send a message to the one directly below it?
No. This is a, her question is, can't this cell signal this cell? This kind of cell, called a motor neuron, doesn't branch and only goes from the spinal cord to the effector. Yeah?
Does every single muscle cell have a nerve input?
Every skeletal muscle cell is controlled by one or more by nerves. Now, what I want to talk about, this picture is only half. Of course, this one has two also. We've only drawn half of the circuit to make it clear. Now, only part of it. Now, what I want to consider is the rest of those the handout today, which is the overall setup of the nervous system. And the first thing you want to look at is the top of B. this shows you what the big main divisions are. Now, what we've drawn here in the middle is the central nervous system, meaning both the brain and the spinal cord. And remember, everything else is the peripheral nervous system. So you have information coming in, as we did before. You have information coming in and information going out. And this is distinguished along this picture. Afferent is information coming in and efferent out, as with previous circuits. But in this case, you get two kinds of afferent or in information. One is the kind we just talked about, which is unconscious due to sensory neurons. And they generally have their bodies on the side, which is why I drew it like this. So this is unconscious. And this is largely from internal organs, not from the outside. And then you have the conscious sensory input. And this is from your eyes and your ears and so forth, and you're usually aware of this. Now, in addition, these are just the nerve input. Of course, you have other inputs such as hormones into the central nervous system, but we're not talking about, we're sticking to nerves for the moment. Now, what is the afferent, what comes out? So the information you get from internal and external is used to pick things up, walk around, etc. How is that done? You have to contact the effectors. And the obvious effector is the one we've just talked about, which is your skeletal muscle. And the other possibility is everything else. That's the smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands, and your GI tract. Now, the efferent part of the peripheral nervous system is then divided into these two halves. The neurons that contact your skeletal muscles and the neurons that contact everything else. And the neurons we just talked about are part of the kind that contact skeletal muscle, and they're called motor neurons. And you can see from the picture that there's a single neuron that has its body in the central nervous system that goes all the way to your skeletal muscle. And that's why you have these very long neurons, these very long motor neurons, like the one from here to your toes, the famous one in the blue whale. But you notice if you look at your picture over here that there are two branches. But the critical thing is that each of these has two neurons. This is called the autonomic system, as opposed to the somatic. And in order to send a signal to glands, smooth muscle, etc., it takes not one nerve cell, but two. So you have a first and a second nerve cell. And the first one is called preganglionic. And the second one, not per, but pre. And the second one is called post. Now, why do we say that? There's a cell, there are actually many neurons here together. And all of these neurons have their cell bodies together in a bunch. And a bunch of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system is called a ganglion. So the first set of cell bodies are inside here, inside the central nervous system. The second set of cell bodies are in ganglia. And so we have the preganglionic cell and the postganglionic cell. And the autonomic is divided again into two parts, which are called the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. Now, as illustrated in this picture, they differ in where the ganglia are, relatively close to the central nervous system or relatively close to the target organ. They also differ in which neurotransmitters they use. And they differ one more way in that the general effect, that this, the stress response is run by a mixture of hormones and the sympathetic system. The sympathetic system generally juices you up. And the parasympathetic generally calms you down. People tend to think of parasympathetic as turning things off and sympathetic as turning things on, but that's not always true. Because the parasympathetic actually allows your GI tract to digest things, and the sympathetic turns it off. Because in the case of the pop quiz or the famous lion in the street, it's not the time to digest lunch. So these are not on-off signals so much as they are general calm-down signals and general juice-up signals. Now, the final part on the very back is a summary of the differences. And I want to say something briefly about it and then bring it back and we'll go about it a little bit more next time. That the one on the top represents the somatic system, that you have a single nerve cell which has its body in the CNS and its terminal on a skeletal muscle, on an effector. The parasympathetic and the sympathetic have this relay system of two neurons. And the final thing that's written down here on the bottom is the adrenal medulla. The adrenal medulla secretes epinephrine, which is the hormone that reinforces the stress response. How does that fit in? It's considered part, in some ways, of the sympathetic system. That in these systems, you have one neuron kicks in a second neuron, which kicks in an effector. In the adrenal medulla, the first neuron kicks in the second neuron. But the second neuron simply releases epinephrine into the bloodstream. So if people think of the adrenal medulla as having the first neuron and then the second neuron, instead of contacting an effector like a muscle or a gland, it simply releases epinephrine into the bloodstream. It is almost, its job is signaling, and then that goes through the bloodstream and triggers the appropriate effectors. So we'll go over the transmitter business next time, which system uses which transmitter, which receptor, all this business about the nicotinic and the muscarinic. Now I have the exams from all of the sections. I want to give out the ones for C, Section 1 first, and then if anybody is willing to stay long enough, we'll give out the others. I will also give them out tonight, and if you come during my office hours, I can give you your exam. If any TAs are here to help, I'd appreciate it. I know a lot of them come in the afternoon, so...